Where the Bodies Are Buried contains graphic depictions of violence that some listeners may find disturbing. Discretion is advised.
My name is Phil Chalmers, and this is Where the Bodies Are Buried.
The devil is on my side.
Joining me are my producers, Adam and Samantha.
On this episode of Where the Bodies Are Buried, we are speaking with a seemingly normal man brought up in a nice, normal family in a normal home. But behind the scenes, things were far from normal. He believes early exposure to violence and pornography crossed the wires in his brain and led him to become a serial killer. Now he sits in prison at Pontiac Correctional Center for 2 murders and suspected of 5 more. He claims to be remorseful and wants to help prevent further crime with his story. Oh, and his partner in crime? His own wife.
This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording.
So we are on the phone with Paul Runge. His name is R-U-N-G-E. Paul is incarcerated in the state of Illinois. What prison are you in, Paul?
Pontiac Correctional Center.
Maximum security. Is it okay if I record you today?
Okay, that's fine.
What are you in prison for right now? What is your sentence and what was it for?
I'm in prison right now on a double murder case from 1997. My sentence was a death sentence, and Illinois abolished the death penalty in 2011, and my sentence was commuted to life prison without parole.
Okay, so you have a life without parole sentence for 2 homicides.
It was a double murder.
A double murder. And you're suspected of
others,
like 7 maybe?
I was suspected of five other murders.
Okay, so a total of 7.
Yes.
You had a co-defendant. You had a co-conspirator. Who was that?
That at the time, that was my wife, Charlene.
And she was involved with these crimes as well?
Yes.
That's very, very rare, I think. So how do you end up incarcerated for life? How in the hell does that happen? And I'm sure you think about it every day when you lay your head on your pillow at night. How did you get there? What happened?
Well, I know how I got here, believe it or not. I have done exactly what you said, but I've also talked to a lot of forensic psychologists over the years, professors and so on, and kind of being honest is what's really helped, because it gives people an idea how to understand the possibilities of why. And I believe that it was based on, you know, when you're real little and you're really young, your mind is wiring, you know, it's connecting to different things. And I think that somehow sexual gratification and violence, I think they kind of got the wires crossed. And that's really kind of what I bonded to at the time as very young.
Okay.
You know, through the through movies. I mean, you know, my favorite movies when I was little were like Frankenstein, Dracula, you know, the old black and white movies with Bela Lugosi and so on.
Yeah, the old horror movies, stuff like that.
Yes, and you know, if you notice, back then and even now, they always seem to have beautiful women as the victims in these movies. They objectify the women.
Yeah.
And that's who, you know, you don't see... I don't mean to be disrespectful to the larger women that are listening, or if they are going to listen to the podcast, you don't usually see people that aren't attractive or, you know, what society views as beautiful as victims.
Right. And so you felt like that had a major impact on you, plus you had maybe a predisposition to violence.
I do, because that was my first kind of remembering of any kind of sexual feelings. And then also through the movies, as time went on, the harder R-rated and X-rated, you know, movies that had sex and violence and objectification, even comedies. And even today, I mean, we portray the same thing. Why do we make a movie of, why is there 3 or 4 Ted Bundy movies out? And, you know, what's the purpose of that? What are we showing? I mean, Ted Bundy had fans and women that wanted to marry him and all this kind of stuff, but yet he killed all these women. And, you know, we put that on TV and we watch it. I mean, there's a reason we watch it, and that's why people make it. I mean, I don't understand it.
Were you addicted to pornography as well, growing up, as well as horror movies?
Yes. I mean, well, the horror movies came first, and then it kind of mixed. You know, there was a famous artist that started mixing horror and porn together, Andy Warhol. And, okay. You know, that when his movies came out, I was able to rent those from the video store at a young age because they were in the horror section, not in the pornography section.
And what kind of, where did you get access to porn? I mean, was it, is this before the internet? Was it magazines and videos, or was
oh,
it?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. The internet came out after I was locked up, 97.
So how did you get access to
porn? I started watching the stuff in the 70s, in the late 70s.
How did, what were you doing? How were you getting access to porn?
I had older friends. They had, you know, they would have their father's magazines and move, you know, the Betamax movies before the VHS came out, and we would watch them on those type of things.
What age, Paul, did you what age were you when you first had your first thought of possibly sexually assaulting or killing somebody?
Probably fourth grade. I don't know the age, but I do remember it was like fourth grade.
So you're about 9 years old. You already had this thought. And when you had that thought, did you say to yourself, that's messed up? Or did you say to yourself, I'd like to do that someday?
I don't know if I thought like in the future. I was more like just kind of in the moment kind of thing. I was thinking about it from watching it. Mm-hmm. I remember it was from one of the old black and white werewolf movies. And I remember that the werewolf, he was, you know, out doing his thing. And he looked in a window and he saw a female dancing or doing something like that. And he was excited. He went in and he attacked her and killed her in the movie. Then, of course, they don't show the graphic violence like they do now, but, you know, she was dead after he left.
Okay.
And I remember she was beautiful, and I remember him, you know, being a monster.
And you thought, that could be me.
I think I was attracted to her, and then I seen what he did, and I was thinking to myself, you know, that was kind of like really one of my first introductions to any kind of the sex and the violence together.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it just kind of got reinforced through other movies and things I've seen since then.
So Paul, that was, you're 9 years old. When you commit your first violent crime, be it rape or murder, when was your first, how old were you when you committed your first violent crime?
17.
Was it rape or murder or both?
No, it was a rape.
Okay, so you started out, and that's what a lot of people say. Now, before that, were you involved in any kind of like voyeurism, peeping Tom, anything like that?
No, actually, I was lucky in the sense that I came from a nice middle class family, mm-hmm. and I was popular. I was good in school. I had good at athletics. I was involved in a lot of sports. So actually having girlfriends and having sex and, you know, threesomes and all that started when I was in eighth grade.
So you had a pretty normal family and a pretty normal upbringing.
Yes, except for the sex. That's the one thing that was very different because my friends would be shocked.
Except for the sex. You were really into sex even starting in eighth grade.
Yes. Even with older women. So, I mean, it all kind of was very strange at that time.
Well, you're a very good-looking guy.
If you watch the Jersey Shore and you watch New Pauly D is on the Jersey Shore, a lot of people nickname me that.
Okay.
Because at the time, I looked and dressed pretty much the same.
And you grew up in Illinois. Is that your home state?
Yes, I grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago.
And your crimes were committed in the same area or somewhere else?
Yes, in the same area.
Okay. So you grew up in a normal family. You got girlfriends, you're having sex, but you got this little thing that's tugging on you that I guess you can't quite get rid of.
Exactly. I mean, I started reading the true crime books. First of all, a friend introduced me when I was young to the true crime True Detective magazine.
Right.
Which, if you look at any cover, you're going to see a beautiful woman being stalked or attacked by somebody, and the stories are the same. And then it went to the true crime books, which is real cases. And then it was the shows, and you know they've documentaries and shows on pretty much anyone that's, you know, a high-profile killer. Is there's a movie or a TV show about it, or a book.
A lot of guys have started out with the detective magazines. Ted Bundy, Dennis Rader, Ed Gein. These detective magazines where women are afraid, they're in fear, they're tied up. That's the magazines you're talking about, right?
Yeah. Yes. Do you see any ugly women?
No. You won't see that. You won't see that on there. Those are they're like bathing beauties, right?
Exactly, and there. I mean, the whole thing is sex and violence. Sex and violence. I mean, it really was in my. You know, my friends would say, "Wow, why do you always get horror movies when we like to come over and that stuff and rent movies?" and I would always have like the B movies, you know, the ones that showed the most nudity and
most stuff. Yeah, I got you. Okay, call me back, Paul. I'm going to pause here. We'll call me back in 30 minutes, right?
Okay, about 30, 35 minutes.
That's perfect. I'll be ready.
All right. Bye. Take care. Thank you.
It seems like we're running into blaming movies, porn, and games a lot. Whether people believe that or not, I think Paul's wires were crossed long before porn. I mean, the first time he thought about killing and raping a woman was after watching a werewolf movie.
I mean, yeah, obviously he had some mental problems prior to all this. His wires were crossed, if you want to say it that way. But he had obviously had a mental deficiency. So it's the perfect storm. You have a guy that has some mental deficiencies. He's obsessed with sex. And he's into violent entertainment and violent porn. All this stuff works together to kind of inspire him to go out and do these kind of acts. And I asked him several times, even off the record, why not just have sex with your wife? Why not just have sex with the prostitute? Why do you have to do this? And this is what he was addicted to. He was addicted to the hunt. In fact, he just got off on every day he went to work, he would just pretend that was his next victim. And he became addicted to the hunt of killing people. And literally every woman that he came across was a potential victim if the situation was perfect. So, yeah, I mean, I think you can be inspired by violent entertainment, pornography, and a lot of guys have been inspired. But obviously, we can't just blame porn. It's a lot more than that. It's multiple reasons. It's mental deficiencies. It's addictions to violence and sex. And it becomes a perfect storm.
So he mentioned his partner in crime was his wife. We need to know more about this. Who is his wife?
You know, we don't know much about his wife. Her name is Charlene, and she was definitely involved in some of these cases. There's been a lot of husband and wife serial killing duos out there, and it's a very dangerous duo because women will let their guard down if they're being approached by another female. So, you know, when a man approaches a woman, they kind of have their guard up. But when a female approaches them, a lot of times they are more open to cooperating, right? And so a lot of these famous serial killers did have women helping them, and it increased their body count. Paul actually jumps into this a little later in the interview.
So did his wife get caught?
They suspected his wife, Charlene, of being involved in a couple of the abductions and a couple of the murders. I think she was more involved in helping acquire the victims for him, in the kidnapping and the luring of the victims. And then Paul Runge would have killed them and raped them. I don't think she was involved in the rapes and murders. But for some reason, she never got charged and never did one day in prison. We've heard what Paul thinks turned him into a violent killer. When we come back, we're going to hear more about his life of crime and murder. If you're looking for more serial killer and true crime content, check out my YouTube channel at True Crime Phil. We've talked to Paul Runge about how entertainment such as porn and violent movies at a young age made him think evil thoughts. Now we're going to hear about how those evil thoughts turn into reality. All right, we're back with Paul Runge. So I went over some of your cases. What case are you in prison for? What double murder are you in there for?
I'm incarcerated right now for the Gutierrez case and the Munoz case.
Munoz case. Okay, so was that a mother and a daughter?
Yes.
Okay, and that's what you're convicted of. That's what you're serving time for.
Yes.
So the other cases that you're suspected of, Paul, they just decided not to charge you. They didn't feel the need to charge you for those. Is that what they did?
I was charged for the charged, but yep. Then once I got the sentence, they didn't want to pursue any more cases because they believed that, you know, it would be a waste of money because Illinois has a lot of problems with money. Gotcha. So that's the reason they got rid of the death penalty. But they knew that they couldn't give me anything more than a death sentence, so they just. Now they cross the case. So that was there. Pick the cases back up. It's just a life sentence again.
I got you.
They would only do that if I was ever going to get out of prison.
So, Paul, you committed some pretty violent crimes. I mean, not many people know who you are, so you've kept a very low profile, but you've committed some pretty violent crimes, including, you know, rape, murder, you know, dismemberment, and all that kind of stuff. Go ahead. Okay. What do you got to say about that?
I'm violent in the sense of, yes, both, you know, rape is a violent crime, murder is a violent crime, dismemberment, to me that's, you know, once you kill somebody, you don't see them as, I mean, you really don't see them as a person when you kill them anyways.
Right.
So when, you know, the dismemberment is more of a survival tactic to not get arrested or not get caught.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you next.
But there's nothing in my cases as far as nobody knows anything except me as far as what happened. And
okay,
that's the bad thing because people can assume the worst. They can imagine the worst. But mm-hmm. the fact of the matter is it really wasn't the worst. And I mean, I without going into everything, which yep. I'm not trying to exploit my, you know, the victims or their mm-hmm. families or, you know, disrespect them any more than I already have with my actions. I'm not really trying to get into that, but it really wasn't what you think. It wasn't like,
so if I'm understanding this, it was all driven by sex. So it was a lust crime. And then after you committed the sex act, you pretty much had, you just kind of felt like, if I don't kill these people, I'm going to get arrested. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, there was no, I mean, it's horrible as it is. I mean, I'm not denying that. And I, you know, it's horrific. And I've just spent the years trying to overcome that and change. And, you know, like I'm a model inmate. I have no tickets, no disciplinary issues in 21 years. So, I mean, I'm not a troublemaker in that sense.
Here's the biggest question I have. Paul Runge is 9 years old and starting to think these thoughts. He's discovering things. He's watching things. And at 13, he starts to have sex. And I think your mom died when you were 17.
Yes, and I called my case 3 weeks later.
Right, that's what I'm saying. 3 weeks later. So that really did that really hurt you when mom died?
I think that my mom was more the authoritarian in my you know, between my parents. And I think that our relationship was really strong as far as she would call me on my issues.
Okay.
And, you know, like normal stuff. And the fact that we had that relationship, I really didn't want to disappoint her or, you know, do things that were going to like embarrass a family or whatever. And we were really close when she had cancer. You know, I took her to chemo when I could, because, you know, my father worked and she was off work at the time. Mm-hmm. So we got really, our relationship got stronger over those times. And I think not knowing what hospice was at the time, not knowing any of those things, when she actually passed away, I didn't think she was going to pass away. None of my family actually believed that she was going to die. And I took it the hardest and I just didn't care.
So at that point,
not caring is at that point.
At that point, you didn't care.
I didn't care. And I think that I just, you know, what boundaries I had, what, you know, limits I had just disappeared.
It was wide open then. So your mother died, and later that year you kidnapped, raped, and beat a 14-year-old girl in Oak Forest. So you committed this crime at 17, you get arrested and you got sentenced to 14 years and you did seven, yeah. You got paroled. And you probably realize what a lot of people think as far as this goes is, you know, I can't let anybody survive next time because I will go, you know, I will go forever to prison anyways. And
right. That's
typically what we see. And then, you know, you started committing your crimes in 95, and then you started escalating, like they were happening quicker and faster and closer together. And that's kind of what we always see, Paul, where you commit a crime, then, you know, like maybe like, you know, 6 months later, and then 3 months later, and then 2 months, and then 1 month. It just kind of escalates, and it's almost kind of like you.
I'm going to tell you something real quick.
Yep.
That I agreed with that based on what I read on other cases. Mm-hmm. The problem is, my crimes were crimes of opportunity. Once the opportunity in my situation changed, the crime stopped. I went from driving a 7-Up truck and being on a sales route out there, mm-hmm. and that where I could go anywhere and on my own time, to having to work in the city in downtown Chicago, which took away any opportunities because I was in downtown, and everything stopped.
Wow.
And it really did. Everything stopped just because the opportunity was no longer there. So
okay. When
you hear of people stopping or crime stopped, people must have moved or got arrested, that is not always the case. Something changes in the situation where it's not the way it was.
Wow. Interesting.
I wasn't the kind of person that says, I'm going to take this unnecessary risk and do something like, at the time it was like, okay, well, this is no longer the situation. So
yeah. It's
not like that. So I went to another way, and it had nothing to do with being happy, being stressed, being depressed. and none of that stuff was the factor.
So Paul, from the time you got out of prison, 94, 95, to the time you got arrested in May of 97, we know how many victims that you had, but how many women did you target that survived? Like I don't mean even attack, but you just like, you thought like this would be a perfect victim and just something happened and they got away. Or just didn't work out, or something.
I couldn't even tell you because, you know, like I said, it's opportunity. So right. You might think, and then the opportunity's not there, and okay, move on.
So that happened a lot, didn't it? So a lot of people had no idea that they came that close to being victims.
Absolutely.
Wow. If you were going to guess how many women that escaped, you know, got lucky, how many would it be in the course of those 3 years?
I honestly couldn't even tell you.
Just guess.
I mean, you know, because it was almost like it was almost a daily thing after a point. You know, when the first thing happened and with my wife, when I told her about what was going on in my head, and if she would have did something right then and there, I would have been locked up on a parole violation. I would have never been on the street again.
Gotcha.
But she took it a totally different way. And so I'd say from somewhere in late 94, when it was kind of like, you know, no big deal to her, mm-hmm. believe it or not. Mm-hmm. It kind of changed it from that point on. It was like, I don't know. Okay. Well, now how, who, yeah. And you know, that was kind of the first, you know, thing with her. And, you know, she actually picked. So
wow.
there, that's yeah.
Did she get prison time?
No, she didn't do a day in prison or jail.
Wow. So Paul, at that point, when you're in that situation, the only way you're going to get the only way you're stopping is you're going to get arrested or die. Is that pretty much like it takes over you? Like you can't stop it. Is that correct, Paul?
At that time, back then, yes.
It was all consuming, right?
Pretty much. I mean, I still was able to function as far as my work and that kind of stuff. Believe it or not, I didn't. There was no anything that changed in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, like I said, it was just opportunity. One was the opportunity when I would not get in trouble. Or I would not raise suspicion about my actions.
The average person is going to ask this question. Well, Paul, I mean, you had all the women you wanted. If you wanted sex, you could have just picked up a prostitute or got a girlfriend. What was it about this that was different than just going to pick up a prostitute or just having your own girlfriend or picking up a bar fly or something like that?
I think that the issue is when you build fantasies in your mind, you're trying to achieve the fantasy. And the fact that that was never able to happen with a normal relationship, I think that's what pushed it to going outside. And the problem was, even that never actually achieved, you know, the fantasy into me. So I realized it wasn't, now over time, I realized it was never going to happen. And I was just chasing something that wasn't possible.
Are these kind of people you just came across in one day? Or is this somebody you kind of stalked for months or something like that?
No, never like a long process. It was just a short kind of opportunity thing.
Okay. Yeah. You had relationships with women. I'm sure you had girlfriends and you had a wife. How did you treat the women in your life? Did you treat them rough or did you treat them nice?
But I'd say that, you know, what they were willing to go along with, that was fine. And if not, okay. I think the only problem was I never, because of objectifying women and seeing them as sexual objects, you really don't ever, you can't really bond to love. So I never really, I didn't hate women. I didn't have anything against women. Like you said, it was kind of a lust thing. Mm-hmm. And I never really bonded in a loving way. I think that was the problem. I never really could say, I love you and mean it, because I really never understood it, because everything I learned was exact opposite as far as relationships with women in a sexual way. That was a really big problem.
I usually I ask all the guys I interview two questions, Paul. Are there any unsolved cases that nobody knows about?
No.
Okay, and have all the remains been located?
Excuse me?
Have all the bodies of the remains been located?
Yes.
Okay, so there's
Well, no, actually no.
Is somebody missing or what?
Well, you know, they believe there's enough for a case, but there's in cases where they haven't found any bodies.
So if you wanted to, could you lead me to any bodies that the police don't know about?
No, I couldn't. Even if I was out and if you told me I could go free to help, I couldn't.
I got you.
Yeah.
I got you. It's interesting. I looked at your case a little bit. Some of the people that you encountered, some of your victims, they were like renting homes or selling things, which I've always thought is very dangerous. That is how you met some of your victims.
Yes.
Was there anything you could give as advice to somebody like a real estate agent, how they could not fall victim?
Here's the problem. Mm-hmm. Ordinarily, it shouldn't be an issue. You're doing your job. You're not causing any problems. You're trying to make a living. Right. Okay, great. The problem is there's people out there that are like I was at the time, mm-hmm. and nothing that has made me the way I am or how I believe mm-hmm. became the way I did has changed in the years. Everything is even more so now because of the internet. You can find things you couldn't find back when I was out.
Right.
So I think that due to the fact that a person might need a private place to pull something like this off, that unless a person has somebody with them, which is unfair because, you know, they're trying to make a living, they want to make money and make a sale when they can, because 99% of the time, everything's going to be fine.
Right.
It's the one time that they don't, that, you know, they don't have someone with them or they trust someone they shouldn't, that something could happen. And in my situation, due to the fact that I had a wife that was, let's just say she was, whatever I wanted to do, she was willing to go along with it.
Right.
It wouldn't even matter, because if it was a husband and a wife or a man and a woman, yep. what woman is not going to be feel right. safe?
Wow. So and they can't tell by the way
you
look.
Many open houses and many, many things, just like you're saying.
Right. Right. And then to take it to another level, if you show up with a woman, their guard really comes down.
Absolutely. And who's going to have their shackles up or their nerves up or worry up when something like right. that happens.
So your advice to them, a typical realtor, a female realtor, it could be for men too, meeting strangers, is there anything they can do to make themselves safer?
Absolutely. I believe, and I think the statistics will back me up. I haven't seen them, but I also haven't seen any new cases like this. Mm-hmm. I believe everything needs to be recorded. Okay. I think they should always have a way of recording, or always be with, if it's a female, be with a male. If they're two females, somebody has to be the one that's going to be willing to be defensive and have a mace or something. Because I think that in most cases, if somebody fights, that the other person's going to run. Because the whole thing is being able to be private and have nobody know what's going on.
Right. So, wow. Did you know eventually you were going to get caught?
Of course.
You knew the end game in this. You knew what was going to happen.
You always do. Everyone does. I mean, and now if you notice, you're not even hearing about the cases that much anymore because, you know, now we have more security with cameras and.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Paul, real quick, I know
you want me to call you back if I can.
You can't call me back and you can, but let me just say this real quick. Did you just, everybody says that guys like you kill animals growing up, wet the bed, and set fires. Did you partake in any of those behaviors?
Absolutely not. I'm a pet lover. I've always loved pets. So I've always had pets, and never a fire, nothing whatsoever.
So you didn't have any of those warning signs?
Oh, no, not at all.
All right, the husband and wife killing team.
Yeah, I mean, there's over 3,200 serial killers in America, and only a handful have worked with a girlfriend or a wife. So a husband and wife team is rare, but it has happened several times. There's been quite a few famous husband and wife teams. One of the biggest ones, Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown out of Ohio. The Sunset Strip Slayer out of California. Douglas Clark, Carol Bundy. The Toy Box Killer in New Mexico. There's been quite a few of these husband and wife teams. Again, the reason it's so dangerous is when you have a woman helping you lure victims, it becomes very easy to get a woman to cooperate. And when it does happen, it's very dangerous, and there could be a very high body count because you have a woman luring another woman to her death.
Talk to us more about his crimes. You know, he was a little vague on what was going on, but what was this guy all about?
Yeah, does he not want to discuss his actual crimes?
There's a couple reasons why killers don't want to talk about their crimes. They might be trying to get a new deal. They might be trying to get parole. They might be trying to get an. They may be working on an appeal. They may be embarrassed of their crimes. Like, They want to distance themselves from their crimes and their past. And there's a very small percentage that are actually remorseful about their crimes, and they don't want to glorify their crimes by talking about them. I would say Paul Runge is a bit remorseful about his crimes, and he's also a bit embarrassed about the kind of crimes he committed. Because when you see a picture of Paul Runge, he's kind of a good-looking guy. When you read his crimes, they're very heinous. He would lure women into an area. He would lure women into a home. He would beat them, knock them out with the dumbbell. He would dismember them in his bathtub. He would rape women and children. He would dismember their bodies, put them in plastic bags, and dump them around town. I mean, the kind of crimes we're talking about are pretty heinous. Some of the bodies were burned, and they were discovered by firefighters. Some of them had their throats cut before they were set on fire. So these crime scenes were very graphic and very violent. So why isn't he not a big fan of talking about his crimes? I think he's a bit remorseful, and I think he's a bit embarrassed about how graphic and shocking his crimes are, including killing children. He might be in denial a little bit about his crimes because he did do some acts of torture. He did slit some of his victims' throats. He did beat some of them to death. He did set some of them on fire. His acts are not as innocent as he might describe. Next, we will be speaking with forensic psychology professor and author Catherine Ramslin. And we will wrap up our call with serial killer Paul Runge. We're about to talk with forensic psychology professor and author Catherine Ramslin, and we will wrap up our call with Paul Runge. Hello, it's Phil Chalmers.
Hi, it's Catherine Ramslin.
Thanks so much for taking the time to call. Tell us what you're doing now. You've written 60 books.
No, 68.
Are you still working at a college? Are you still a professor?
I'm the assistant provost at DeSales University in Pennsylvania, and I'm a full professor there. I teach forensic psychology at the undergraduate and graduate level.
So we're talking about a serial killer named Paul Runge. What do you think about him? Why did he have to kill these women? What do you think drove a person like Paul Runge?
He's definitely a sadistic person. The fact that Runge actually took a lot of pains to hide evidence, to dismember bodies and just put them in bags and distribute the body parts in various places, to light different places on fire to try to destroy evidence, suggests that he certainly did know that what he was doing was wrong and had criminal consequences. And I think when we look at the details of that assault when he was 17 on a 14-year-old girl, we're going to understand a lot more about what compels his behavior. What we do see with the victim, the 14-year-old victim when he was 17, is that he tortured her for 14 hours, biting, using a knife on her, raping her in various ways, forcing oral sex on her, hitting her, yelling at her, binding her, blindfolding her. I mean, all the things that he did to her over the course of 14 hours. And then he was interrupted, which is how she got away. He had actually bound her, gagged her, put her into a sleeping bag, and put her into a crawl space, expecting, obviously, to return to continue to work on her. And one of the things I thought was interesting in a comment he made to her is he was biting her, and she was crying, and he yelled at her and said something like, "Stop crying, it doesn't hurt." And I noticed that that's really a pattern in his behavior, to minimize what he's doing to people or what he has done to people. When you look at his confessions versus the forensic reports, he clearly does not take responsibility. He seems to, in the interviews he did with you, he seems to be very conversant with what he did and to say, yes, he belongs in prison, etc. But when you look at the things that he said he did versus kinds of things we see on the reports, he clearly minimizes what he's doing to victims. Runge likes to bring women under his control, raping them in, you know, anally, vaginally, orally, and then killing them, I think because he has to eliminate them, not because he derives pleasure from the act of murder itself. So there's a distinction to be made between those who are less killers in terms of it's the murder itself that they want versus those who want to see through their paraphilia, their sexual needs, and now they have to eliminate a witness because they've just committed a crime.
Contrary to what a lot of people think, Dennis Rader, Paul Runge, they live a pretty normal life. They have normal jobs, and they can get along with society like everybody else.
He had a wife that was apparently part of at least the first three murders. As I'm reading through this story, I'm amazed that the wife really walked away with nothing, because honestly, I think that's astonishing. And it's astonishing to have him be, you know, have her be part of that. So I don't know that he's necessarily living a normal life. I think he's got a lot more deviance in his life than you would see in someone like Dennis Rader.
Okay, interesting. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. All
right, thanks, Catherine. Have a great day.
All right, you too. Bye. Bye.
Are you remorseful for your crimes?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, when I had the death penalty, I totally accepted it. I mean, I was okay. I was at peace with it, actually, because I mean, I earned it by what happened, and I mean, now I'm in life, and I don't want to have a life sentence. I don't want to get out of prison. I believe I should stay here, and I'm not ever going to try to get out of prison. I just had to. I had to realize, you know, the pain I caused others in order to finally accept it. And I think I was immature as far as, you know, emotions, and it took time for me to grow and understand and have empathy and all that.
A couple more questions, Paul. Number one, how could we have stopped Paul Runge? Is there anything we could have done, or are you basically saying, listen, man, there's nothing you could have done?
I honestly don't think the, you know, like the forensic psychologist talk, they said it was just the right things happened at the time to create my mind the way it was. The bonding, the wires, that everything kind of solidified into that based on what was going into my brain.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't just, I didn't start out like this. I just, those are things that were implanted in. I mean, you know, people get attracted to shoes. People get attracted to feet. You know, people have fetishes. People have different types of things. And there's a reason why they have these things. Mm-hmm. And it was the same exact thing. I mean, there's people that are into bondage. You know, I'm sure you heard of S&M, mm-hmm. different things like that. Mm-hmm. People are into those things for a reason. And for whatever reason, at that time in my life, when my sexual, when my mind was, you know, being molded at that time, that's what happened.
Last thing I want you to say before I let you sign off, what would you like to say? You're going to have the final parting words here. What would you like to say to the victims' families, society, America? Paul Runge, you got a minute.
Well,
what's your last words?
I don't really know what I could say to the victims' families besides it wasn't a personal thing against them. They didn't do anything to me. I wasn't angry or out to get them and that them individually. I really am sorry for the pain that I caused them, their, you know, their families and their children and, you know, my own family and other people that were friends of mine that are, you know, shocked and terrified by this. There's nothing I can do to change it, except maybe try to prevent it from happening to other families with, you know, my words and, you know, like the work you do. And I think society is really going off the wrong path. I think they really have to go back and look at what they produce. I mean, why is a movie like Devil's Rejects, are people fans of that movie when they just killed and killed and killed? I don't understand it. I mean, if you put that into someone's mind, they're going to think about it. And, you know, we have mass shootings every
year. You have 1 minute remaining.
Oh, well.
Okay. Keep going, Paul. Go
That's
ahead.
All I got.
Go ahead.
We have mass shootings every day. We have killings in other ways. And it's like society just accepts it, and, you know, we want to live our life, do our job, and not, no, it doesn't bother me, I won't worry about it. But the problem is, it's only getting worse and worse and worse. Our culture, our society is turning into, you know, a Sodom and Gomorrah kind of thing, and I don't know if it's ever going to get better. I just see us in a downward spiral, and unless big changes happen, we're in a lot of trouble.
Phil, he didn't really discuss how he finally did get caught.
You know, A lot of serial killers get very careless, especially towards the end, and they start targeting victims that are very close to them. He had a connection to some of these victims, and the police were already onto him. They already suspected him of some of these crimes. They just could not pin these crimes on him. They even did a search of his house, found a lot of items like serial killer books and some things that they thought could be in the home of a serial killer. But it did not directly link him to these particular victims. But they were able to hold him for a probation violation, and during that hold, they got a DNA hit on Paul Runge, and it linked him to the mother and the 10-year-old daughter he killed, Mrs. Gutierrez, and her 10-year-old daughter, Jessica. Like he said, he knew from the beginning he was going to get caught. Paul Runge sits in a prison in Illinois called the Pontiac Correctional Facility. He is serving life without parole for two murders. If you haven't listened yet, don't forget to check out the first season of Where the Bodies Are Buried. This podcast is produced by Grinning Dog Entertainment and Audio Up.